This is Dr. Sarah Howard. The Pure Animal Podcast is growing. We're so excited to share our new Pure Animal Ambassadors with you. Join us monthly as we continue to dive deep into the most recent, relevant, and interesting topics with our new team members. Associate Professor Wendy Boltzer, Small Animal Surgeon. Dr. Meng Siek, Veterinary Dermatologist. Dr. Nicole Rue, Integrative Veterinarian. And Professor Caroline Mansfield, who's a Small Animal Internal Medicine Specialist. We're thrilled about our new offering, and we're sure you'll be able to find inspiration for your practice through the clinical wisdom of our new ambassadors. Welcome to the Pure Animal Podcast, where we enlighten veterinary workers, animal lovers, and pet parents about integrative approaches to veterinary medicine and pet health. Each month, we interview experts in their fields as they share cutting-edge science, clinical wisdom, and inspiration. The Pure Animal Podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay our respects to elders past and present. I'm Dr. Sarah Howard, and joining us today is Dr. Matthew Muir. We are thrilled to have Matthew as our newest ambassador for Pure Animal. His passion and knowledge for integrative veterinary medicine is infectious, and I know we will create some great content together. Matt obtained a double degree in veterinary science and veterinary biology in 2010, with first-class honours from Charles Sturt University. He began work as a mixed animal general practitioner in Griffith, Australia, before moving to the United Kingdom and commencing out-of-hours, emergency and critical care work. After several years abroad, Matt returned to Australia and joined the team at All Natural Vet Care in Sydney. His veterinary interests are wellness and preventative healthcare, soft tissue surgery, integrative dentistry, and all disciplines linked to the gut, skin, and brain. Matt is also the co-founder of Leica, a fresh and whole food dog food company. Hello, Matt, and welcome aboard the Pure Animal team. I'm so thrilled to finally be able to announce that you are a newest ambassador. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks, Sarah, and thanks so much for allowing me to join. It's an honour, and I'm really excited to be part of the team.
Yeah, we are too. And today we're going to be talking about something which we have never spoken about on the podcast before, which is fecal microbiome transplants, or FMT, a very interesting and I think relevant topic at the moment in both human and pet medicine. So I know that you are someone who is at the coalfront of FMT research and using it clinically. I couldn't think of a more perfect person to talk about this. But let's start out with, what is actually the process of a fecal microbiome transfer? Like, what does the actual procedure involve?
Yeah, so I think stepping back from what the procedure involves, I think to set the context for it, the great sort of leader in this in canine and feline medicine would be Dr. Margot Roman from the USA, and she likes to refer to it as microbiome restoration therapy. And the reason that I want to open with that is that we need to think about the fecal microbiome transplant, which is which is an emerging experimental therapy. It does have its roots in Chinese medicine and certainly common in other species, for example, cattle and rabbits, and certainly, as you mentioned, emerging in humans, particularly for C. diff recurrent infection. Mm-hmm. The actual procedure is essentially taking a well-screened donor's fecal microbiome and transplanting it into a recipient that needs it. So that's the kind of the procedure in itself, which we can definitely go into today. But stepping out from that, the wider concept is actually restoring a healthy microbiome and achieving what we call eubiosis. So we're addressing dysbiosis. So I think to set up the understanding, it's important to, I guess, refresh about what dysbiosis is. And the generally accepted definition for dysbiosis, and it does appear that there are many types of dysbioses emerging, but dysbiosis in general is looking at normally decrease diversity of the microbiome, but not always, because sometimes there can be a lot of diversity of many bad players that shouldn't be there. But generally, it's decreased diversity, and especially a decrease in the functional bacteria that are there to do things in the microbiome. So a decrease in the bacterial species used to generate short-chain fatty acids, for example. And fatty acids are important because they protect the mucosa and they stimulate the immune system. So that's the goal of the fecal microbiome transplant. And the reason that we're transplanting fecal material from a well-screened donor is that those dogs that are healthy and have a robust microbiome are more likely to have a rich, diverse, normal microbial community. And when you transplant that healthy population into a dog that needs it, that has dysbiosis, you get a lot of very good species, especially what's called keystone species, so bacteria that play huge roles within the ecosystem of the microbiome. And there's a few mechanisms which we can touch on later as well about how fecal microbiome transplant works. But essentially, we're aiming to restore the intestinal microbial diversity, and we do that by taking this stool. And the way that I like to think about a fecal microbiome transplant is that you've heard perhaps, or our listeners may have heard about, a broad spectrum antibiotic being kind of like a nuclear bomb to the gut microbiome population. Have you heard that that analogy before?
Yes, I have, definitely. Yep.
So when we're thinking about that, we're thinking about, you know, broad spectrum antibiotics being a nuclear bomb, narrow spectrum antibiotics or other antibacterial strategies being more like snipers within the microbiome.
Yeah.
And
that's a really good analogy, actually.
And when I think about fecal microbiome transplant versus the other ways that we can manipulate the microbiome, which is mostly diets, pre, pro, and postbiotics, and herbal medicine, and antibiotics, for example, Tylosin, when I think about a fecal microbiome transplant versus the more snipers, it's like the opposite of that. That if a broad spectrum antibiotic loses everything, a fecal microbiome puts everything back in selected targeted strategies, which certainly selected targeted strategies, for example, probiotics and selective prebiotics, absolutely play a role. And certainly I don't start with FMT as like a first line therapy ever. It's certainly not the first line therapy. But when we're thinking about putting an FMT into a recipient, we're thinking that we're not just getting bacteria, we're getting bacterial products, including the potential for production of antimicrobials from good bacteria called bacteriocins. We're getting hormones, for example, oxytocin. We're getting microRNA. We're getting viral bacteriophages. We're getting a whole host of fungi, a whole plethora of potential medicine and potential good bacteria and other players and other mediators to change what's going on in the intestinal tract of a dog. And so that's kind of the sort of zoomed out view of what it is, and then we can certainly go into what does the procedure involve itself.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about some poo. I think it's it's always a fun topic to talk about. But I have a couple of questions that's just popped up just listening to you now. Great description, and it's been a really good start to our conversation today to set that sort of groundwork. So in terms of, and maybe you're going to cover this later, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but in terms of screening, how do you know whether you have a healthy dog to transfer from? How do you actually know whether their feces is going to be healthy and going to be beneficial for the recipient?
Sure. Yeah, that's like the first step for the procedure is actually donor screening. And donor screening and donor selection is by far one of the key factors as to whether FMT is done well, and it raises a lot of questions about the potential side effects and limitations of it. But for donor screening, essentially what we want to do is look for a young dog, generally between the ages of 2 and probably 6 years old. We have a donor bank in our practice in Sydney and have been doing FMT experimentally with appropriate informed consent in refractory cases for many years now, probably over a decade. Okay. How we screen for dogs is we are screening clinically for both behaviour, and I really want to come to that later and talk about the gut-brain axis because, you know, I love the gut-brain axis. We want to screen for behavior and also health conditions. We obviously want to look for dogs that don't have any evidence of enteropathy, but mm-hmm. we also want to make sure dogs don't have evidence of allergies, skin issues, or adverse food reactions in the gut. We want to look for dogs that ideally, and this is difficult, but it's getting easier over the years, dogs that have never had antibiotics. That's the goal, although that may be a kind of lofty goal, because if the gut microbiome still screens out well, now that we have more microbiome screening tests available, that may not be as important. But historically in our practice, we've looked for dogs that have never had antibiotics, that are between 2 mm-hmm. and probably 6 years of age. We mm-hmm. don't really use dogs that are high cancer risk breeds. For example, like we wouldn't use a golden retriever as a donor. We, like I said, we don't want anxious dogs. And the reason for that is that certainly anxiety and depression, and I know that's a bit of a blurred potential disorder in dogs, but they're actually shown to be transferable via microbiome transplants. The world of FMT research, particularly in germ-free mice, has blown up and produced very insightful findings. Certainly anxiety, depression, autism spectrum, I believe Parkinson's now, Alzheimer's, they've all been shown to be quite transferable via the microbiome, which is kind of mind-blowing.
It is completely mind-blowing.
And then there's also I mentioned earlier that there's many types of dysbioses and abnormal microbiome layouts. And one of them of concern is the oncogenic dysbiosis, so the actual carcinogenic microbiomes. It's been poorly characterized what a carcinogenic microbiome is in dogs. You could probably infer from pockets of research as to what bacteria you wouldn't want to be overabundant. But essentially at this stage, we just kind of assume that the gut microbiome is kind of like genetics. And so we wouldn't want to put genetics from a dog that's at a high cancer risk into another dog, because that's just an unknown. It's never been documented that cancer has been transferred via transplant, but we just remain ultra cautious because it is an unknown and has implications. But I think I don't want to fear people off being like this technique isn't viable and valuable, because when it's being used, the dogs that and cats and potential other species that could benefit from it, they're on a risk benefit. I said, this is not a first line therapy where we're like, dog's got simple diarrhea, let's do a fecal microbiome transplant when they're 6 months old and risk all of these potential transferable conditions. No, we're doing it in dogs that are refractory to immunosuppressants and have chronic weight loss and high canine IBD activity index inflammatory bowel disease. Like, they're the dogs that we were trying it on. We are bringing it forward, and we can go into indications a bit later on, but we are starting to think about, as we refine our thoughts and our protocols about when we could be using FMT, we are starting to think about moving it forward rather than having it as like a last resort therapy. And the reason we're thinking that is because it has the potential to really alter the course of disease and not waste time with like a lot of trial and error and a lot of interventions that have side effect profiles. So the donor screening is really important. The other thing with donors is if the recipient has known or highly suspected adverse food reactions, then the donor should not have eaten reactive foods for about 14 days prior to the fecal collection.
Okay. Yeah, interesting.
And then obviously on top of that, we want dogs to have normal. So that's the clinical assessment, and then we'd look then we'd look subclinically and check a biochemistry CBC, clear them for enteropathogens using like a fecal PCR plus approach. We would then the last thing we do nowadays is use a dysbiosis index measurement, which we send to Texas GI Labs, so Texas A&M University. And we would screen them for both dysbiosis as a dysbiosis index, but also ensure that they have an appropriate abundance of Clostridium heronsis, which is now termed Peptoacetobacter heronsis. But that's a good that's a good Clostridium, and that's a bile acid converter. And that's one of the keystone species that I mentioned earlier, that a lot of dogs will have lost their Clostridium heronsis, and that doesn't bode well for dogs. So that's the donors in our practice need to have abundant levels of Clostridium heronsis, otherwise they're not really a good candidate, and they obviously can't have dysbiosis.
Wow, it sounds very involved finding a donor. I have a couple of questions. So you said that you've got some stored samples, and I guess this might be, I might be answering my own question here, but obviously we know that the microbiome shifts, you know, day to day, hour to hour. So you're doing all of these tests at one point in time. So are you confident when you're taking the sample that the tests that you've done, that you might have done a week prior, are still reflective of the sample that you're taking today? Is that, are you confident enough to do that to then store it to use clinically?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm fairly confident because the microbiome, yes, it's always in flux, but it does return to set point. So it's actually quite a sticky set point. And so provided there's been no diet change or like massive insult, like acute hemorrhagic diarrhea syndrome or history of medication use, then I'd be fairly confident that provided the dog is clinically unchanged and hasn't had any change to their husbandry, that I would expect that we wouldn't see with that much divergence from what their kind of set point microbiome was in within a couple of months. Normally what we do is once we get a hit and a positive that like this is a potential donor, then we go pretty quickly, we move pretty quickly because and start getting quite a lot of stool within the first month after they've been identified as a successful candidate, because the thing is people don't want to be putting their dog's poo in the fridge and bringing it to the vets forever. And what we also don't want is like we have had a couple of donors in the past. We had a donor many years ago that was like a great dog, but then when he had he got like castrated at two, and he licked his incision wound so much that we needed to put him on antibiotics, and I was like quite devastated because like no, like that's like he had such a good microbiome and we can't really use him anymore. Even though he probably could still have been fine had he still had a good microbiome. But essentially, like I said about the nuclear bomb, to me, once a dog's had antibiotics, like they don't really recover the full microbiome in my experience and my interpretation of the research. They say that it can return. And certainly nowadays we have many strategies, for example, like concurrent use of Saccharomyces boulardii during a course of antibiotics to try and minimize the damage of needing to use antibiotics if they are indeed needed. But essentially, we'd prefer to use dogs that have not had antibiotics. The other thing to mention, which I forgot to mention, is we also want dogs that are on a whole food diet. So traditionally we did dogs that were on raw, but now I think we'd probably accept dogs that are raw or lightly cooked. But we wouldn't want dogs fed a ultra-processed diet to be to be on the donor program for a couple of reasons. One, I, based on my experience and interpretation of the research, including reading some manuscripts of papers yet to be that are currently in peer review, a lot of dogs on ultra-processed diet are dysbiotic, and so they wouldn't actually wouldn't actually be able to get onto the program. But then, even if they did, what we would want, so when we, and this is kind of the next step after doing the donor screening and starting to talk about the recipient process, is we would want them on a healthy diet after the FMT. Like, the whole goal of this is to like improve, maximize their chances of a healthy life, right? Like minimize clinical signs in the short term, address like root cause drivers of disease in this instance, like the role of dysbiosis in whatever disease is happening for the dog. Mostly to date, it's been around intestinal associated disease with FMT, but I really want to go into some other areas but with you today. But then, we want them to maximize their long-term health. Like, in our opinion, in practice, that involves a biologically appropriate diet. And the microbiome of the donor, the microbiome is geared functionally to degrade what is present. So if you're looking at a high carb, low protein diet, there's going to be a lot of bacteria that are saprolytic kind of bacteria. So that it's going to be a microbiome that's sort of designed to deal with low protein. Whereas, like, I'd advocate for a higher protein, low carb diet for many reasons, which is a whole nother podcast. and so we would want a functional guild of bacteria that can deal and degrade with the protein, the collagens, and everything associated with that style of feeding. So it's a totally different microbiome need. So the microbiome of a dog on ultra processed is actually more like humanized and more like a monkey microbiome, whereas we want dogs to have a more carnivorous microbiome.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Question. So when you're doing the fecal microbiome transfer, how long does the change last? Like, are you expecting it to be one transfer and then that then alters the recipient's microbiome forever? Is that how effective it is? Or is it something, you know, like, I know with probiotics, you give a probiotic and they're usually transient and they can still have the benefits in the gut health on their way through the gut, but they don't usually last, which is why we give them every day. What's the difference with the fecal microbiome transfer to a probiotic?
Yeah, great question. I think with the probiotic thing and the transient transfer through, like, only working and non-colonizing, with that, the thing to note with that, for which is a side note for our listeners, is that, say, lactobacillus-based probiotics, like, what they do is they have a pro-bifidobacterium growth effect. So whilst they're only transient, they can establish more long-term changes even after discontinuation. So that's a bit blurred, but yeah, totally agree. No, the goal for FMT and actually kind of why we don't do them as much as we used to for the conditions that we used to, so mostly the intestinal disease conditions, is actually Margot Roman told me directly that you've kind of got one shot to get it right, to have that goal of kind of doing it once and then resetting the dog's like whole future clinical course of disease and enact like a very, like, not necessarily cure, but like very durable remission for what's going on for them. And so, yes, the aim is that if you get a successful engraftment colonizing, and one of the main mechanisms that's been sort of proposed for FMT, which I fully support, is what's called niche exclusion and increased competition for nutrition. And so basically what this is that if a dog's dysbiotic, they have probably within the mucin and a biofilm within the gut lining, particularly in the colon, but maybe in the small intestine, they will, and there's certainly other dysbiosis all through the body. In fact, Margot Roman started doing urine transplant into the urobiome now from healthy dog urine. So that's
really
what's
this space for that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, for superbugs. But essentially, the thought is, if you have all of this say, E. coli adhered to the living within, or Clostridium living within a biofilm in the colon, if you put in healthier, stronger, fully symbiotic bacteria versus pathogenic bacteria, or what's called pathobiont bacteria, which is kind of like good guys gone bad. If you put in robust, good bacteria, the goal is that they will come in and actually kind of, this is my own made up view of it, kind of grab the E. coli, pull them out of the wall of the mucin and say, and kill them, and then, or kill them or just like out-compete them, and then they sit there in the site, but there's actually nowhere for the E. coli to live anymore. Right. And so if you have a successful engraftment of good bacteria and they bloom and the terrain's all set up so that they actually succeed, and then the appropriate diet's been put in place, and you've addressed like like food sensitivity factors, and the diet's got the right prebiotics to maintain and support the successful engraftment of that microbiome so it actually stays there, then that can be a one-time deal, and that's the goal. However, many internists and people doing FMT around the world would say to like recheck a dysbiosis index after 4 weeks and see if they need it again. Then there is talk of people that use fecal capsules, which are pleasantly known as crapsules, as like ongoing therapy, kind of more like how you'd use probiotic therapy.
With the same donor, like with the same donor's feces capsulated, the same donor that they had the FMT from?
Some dogs don't even have an FMT. So FMT that I'm talking about is usually rectal, like high retention rectal enema. There's also the possibility of doing endoscopic or FMT. But the crapsules, like the oral bacteria therapy, is often that they've never actually had a like that is the transplant. They've never actually had a starting retention enema.
Oh, okay. So even if you give it orally, you can still expect the benefits all the way down into the large bowel.
And the reason is that when you look at probiotics and looking at the overages needed to like get through the acid of the stomach and get through down to the colon, where, you know, probiotics, potentially we're talking from, depending on the strain, like 100 million being like super low potency to, you know, 1 to 2 billion generally, depending on the strain, being like a moderate dose, and then like 10 billion to 100 billion being like a high dose. There's way more CFUs in stool. So they can lose a lot. And then the other thing to note with FMT and why we need to think about it from an evolutionary natural perspective and not think that this is crazy and out there therapy, is that dogs that are dysbiotic are coprophagic anyway.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. And not just dogs, horses too.
Yeah. And you know, rabbits.
Yeah, rabbits.
The puppies eating the mother's stool is potentially a way that they inoculate their microbiome. So it can work. And certainly with humans with Clostridium difficile, the success rates for that is something like 90% clinical response, which is like blows any other therapy out of the water. And then for the oral capsules, it's something like 88%.
Oh, so it's pretty close.
Yes.
So are you choosing – so you typically would give it via an enema, you said, but when would you choose to use the oral therapy versus endoscopic therapy or an enema? Like what sort of makes you choose what case gets what?
I would choose it when we have good encapsulating processes available. Like there are people that ship in FMT from the States, which I don't agree with, because I don't think we should be bringing a US microbiome into Australia. Yeah. I think it's a bit dangerous, and certainly AQUIS wouldn't appreciate that. So at the moment, we don't offer the kind of crapsules in our practice because the encapsulating process should be freeze dried, and I mean some people are doing just like bits of poop wrapped in meatballs and like kind of shoving them down a dog's throat, which I know sounds I know it sounds gross, but dogs are gross. Like, it's, I think they willingly eat it. But no, we go for the FMT. And the other thing with FMT, sorry, the rectal approach is that I do think that there's just a better chance of engraftment when you get a big dose of it straight into the transverse colon. And then the other thing that's kind of emerging and something that we're developing a protocol around is actually using rectal cefalation ozone therapy as a pre-treatment to actually prepare the transverse colon to have a better engraftment rate. And that that involves pumping oxygen and ozone into the microbiome into the transverse colon to generate to invigorate stem cells deep in the crypts in the intestinal wall to actually start producing more mucin and improving the terrain so that the new bacteria had somewhere to live. And the ozone also breaks up biofilm. And so that means that the particularly something like persistent Clostridium, breaking up that biofilm means that you can then have a more successful enema.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether you give any like oral biofilm disruptors before treatment.
Yeah.
Either.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So so rewatch, should I go through like the process of the recipient preparation before getting to that step?
I think we should. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll mention FMT as an option and that we work towards it. Often depending on we'll talk about gut problems first, and then I want to talk about a few other things. But with the gut problems, what we want to do is we want to start them on we want them on a diet that's like a whole food diet and prebiotics, like functional prebiotics beforehand, so that we can know that once we do the FMT that it's more likely to stick, in inverted commas. So we'd want to sort of try to move them onto a diet. So that's forms another food responsive trial to sort of diagnose food responsive enteropathy. And nowadays, with our use of prebiotics, probiotics, especially selective prebiotics based on the dysbiosis, the microbiome mapping results that we get, we often don't need to go to fecal microbiome transplant because we have a whole range of like herbs, nutraceuticals, prebiotic fibers and things that have evidence for being selective, both selective antimicrobials, for example, like berberine, and selective prebiotics for certain missing or low abundant positive strains, and then moving to a high protein, low carb diet, and even changing the proteins from like chicken to beef can upregulate or selectively grow certain good bacteria. So we can try to bloom out good bacteria, which the thing is, if you know how I'm saying, like we're putting in a whole bunch of good bacteria to get out the bad guys. The thing is, the good bacteria could already be in the recipient's microbiome, but just kind of like critically endangered. And so if we directly feed that back up, it could outcompete the bad guys.
That makes a lot of sense.
We're still doing, and that's why at the very start I was like, look, it's not just FMT, it's microbiome restoration therapy. If we can restore the microbiome without needing to do the FMT, it's safer.
So
we'd be using things like, we use a lot of turkey tail mushroom, lion's mane mushroom, resveratrol, turmeric, inulin, berberine I mentioned. We use a couple of Chinese herbal formulas for selective antimicrobials. There's one called agastache that has rhubarb in it, treated rhubarb. So we're getting them onto a whole food diet that's high protein, low carb, appropriate prebiotics, appropriate omega-6 to 3 balance, free from ingredients that could be causing gut lining damage, because dysbiosis also invariably means a lack of intestinal barrier integrity. So we've got the likelihood of gut hyperpermeability. So as a general rule, I'd be avoiding gluten-containing ingredients and being very low, if any, or zero in cereal grains. That's also to reduce the glycemic load. So then we're sort of setting that all up. And monitoring the patient to see if they still need FMT. Then we are antibiotic pretreatment was mentioned and to effectively was previously used in recipient patients to improve the efficacy of the FMT by kind of eliminating
really?
The potential competitive advantage of existing microorganisms that were there, but that's no longer recommended due to judicious use of antibiotic approaches. And also, yeah. from my opinion, there's probably still low levels of resident, like critically endangered keystone species that are the dog's original ones, which I'd like to resuscitate rather than nuke them any further. So then if we're sort of then in the kind of weeks leading up to the microbiome, what we'd do is we'd add some biofilm disruptors and we would actually remove some supplements which might impact and affect the treatment. With regards to biofilm disruptors, if ozone's unavailable, we generally use philodendron as a source of berberine, and we often use N-acetylcysteine as well as ginger. Mm-hmm. The other therapy that we've experimented with and used a couple of times is ozonated hemp oil capsules. So there's there's hemp oil capsules. There's also ozonated hemp oil suppositories available, which we haven't used yet because I'm just not quite comfortable with my safety review of it. But essentially, we would treat for about 10 days with a biofilm buster beforehand, or disruptor more as a better term. Then some veterinary specialists advocate for pre-treatment of the recipient dogs with laxatives such as PEG. We don't do that in our practice, and I'd maybe consider it, but I feel like the herbal approach seems to work. Then on the day that's a kind of lead up with respect to things that we'd stop ahead of time is we'd discontinue antibiotics, colostrum, probiotics, because probiotics could outcompete some of the native FMT bacteria, digestive enzymes, and any bowel motility drugs or herbs. We'd stop all of those, as well as any flea, tick, heartworm, oral preventatives. So that's how we would go about it. And then with respect to the actual procedure, we're looking at putting about 5 grams per kilogram of body weight of recipient of donor stool, and we dissolve that in warm saline, and that's strained through some gauze swabs. Some people blend it, but we just, like in our practice, we've always just strained it. There's also a protocol on Texas A&M Uni about how they, because we also use glycerol to deep freeze store it as well, so people can go there, and happy to give you some papers to put on the show notes. Then we don't feed, and we restrict recipients' activity for about 4 to 6 hours afterwards, and we discourage defecation. If they do poo, so be it, but we don't kind of encourage them to poo for a few hours. And then that's kind of the procedure. And then should we talk about what indications we might use it for beyond gut?
And then we'll loop round to how you can actually measure success of the therapy a little bit later on. So let's go into the candidates and how you're choosing pets that need this, what the indications are, and then we can loop back into how you see them respond.
Keen to touch on, and I can touch on the sort of clinical response that we might expect. So we've talked a lot about intestinal originated disease, and that's the kind of obvious place we'd use it. So really the indications is like a classical dysbiosis, so something like an antibiotic responsive enteropathy or like recurrent C. perfringens. Certainly treatment resistant IBD is something that we'd look at, or more of that IBS picture now with the dysbiosis component. So certainly you'd be just looking to see, nowadays I'd be doing a Texas dysbiosis index and seeing, are they dysbiosis positive or negative? If they're positive, then I think that they're a candidate for FMT, particularly if they don't have, if they have an underabundance of Clostridium heronsis or Peptoacetobacter heronsis. But beyond that, I touched on this before, is the gut-brain axis and using it for behavior cases, which I've actually started doing.
Right.
I've started using it for dogs that have extreme. I did a case last week or 2 weeks ago, which was a bull terrier with extreme OCD food picker. And this dog's like less than 2 years old and already had like 3 excisional laparotomies to remove things from its gut.
Goodness.
And like has like tried to eat a ceramic bowl. And that's when the owners were like, let's just move forward with the FMT. Like, because I'd started doing colostrum and a few other strategies, like setting up the prep work, and we hadn't even done the first dysbiosis, but they were like, look, this is so bad, let's just move forward with it,
try everything,
because they were considering euthanasia. So we just moved forward with it. Haven't heard the outcomes of that yet, but essentially I think I've spoken on another podcast about how dogs with phobia and aggression have different, statistically significant different microbiome layouts from normal behaved dogs. And I mentioned before that fecal microbiome transplant in rodent models has, particularly germ-free mice, has found that if you take like the stool from a autism spectrum neurodivergent human and transplant that into a germ-free mouse, you start to see ASD-like symptoms and behavioural phenotype expression in the mice. So that's and potentially that's another podcast to talk about. So-called canine dysfunctional behavior, or the potential for canine autism, which to me is an interesting topic and something that
I kind of think
about when I'm talking about treating anxiety in dogs. I kind of take that neurodivergent paradigm into effect. But using FMT for behavior patients is pretty amazing. And Margot Roman, who I've mentioned before, like she talks a lot about some amazing cases where behavior has improved. And a lot of dogs with behavioral, or in cats with behavioral issues, have gut issues as well. So there's a lot of crossover there anyway. The other big one that they talk about is obesity. I don't think it's really relevant to use FMT for obesity, because I think that a high protein, low carb diet with appropriate fiber is very effective at that. So I think that obesity is not really one that I would say is important. The other ones that are of interest to me is heart disease, HP, pancreatitis, liver kidney disease, autoimmune disease, and then interestingly, hormone replacement after desexing from entire dogs. So there's a case report from a cat that Margot Roman transplanted a fecal microbiome transplant from a male entire cat to a middle-aged neutered cat, and the middle-aged neutered cat started humping things.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah. And then going back to the gut brain, the other big the mechanism of action that they think might play a role in anxiety and neurodivergent improvements, and certainly there's systemic review from this year, from 2023, that found that FMT can reduce distress behavioral symptoms in children with ASD. Has also been shown to like improve spinal trauma response in rodents, like pretty crazy stuff. But the oxytocin is one of the mechanisms there. And I mentioned earlier that hormones come with the fecal transplant as well. So, and I know Margot Roman also uses pregnant dog donors to manipulate the behavior of dogs and make them more like caring, and they lick and cuddle other dogs better when there's like sibling rivalry in houses, for example. But then
going back to
the ones that I think are of interest, cardiac disease, there's been evidence from I think 2021 that E. coli as a producer of TMAO, so trimethylamine oxide, is involved in cardiac chronic cardiac mitral valve disease progression in dogs. And so there's emerging studies in rodents that find that FMT can play a role in improving cardiac outcomes. Liver and kidney disease, the gut liver axis is emerging. A lot of the understanding around that is about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in humans. But in kidney disease, a lot of nephrotoxic GI nephrotoxins, such as like p-cresyl sulfate and other mediators that damage the kidneys are produced by dysbiosis. So it seems to play a role in both of those conditions. So they're sort of exciting ones, which I'm not using it for that yet. Yeah. It's just like on my radar as like future, future use. And then the other big one for me is autoimmune and maybe cancer. I probably would use it for cancer soon, I think, particularly when, you know, treatment options are limited with great long-term success for many cancers. And so I think it is being used for multiple sclerosis in humans. So so lots of different opportunities. Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot in the next 10 years.
Yeah, it's a lot more than I originally thought was. I really thought it was just sort of limited to, you know, gut disorders only, but it makes a lot of sense, everything that you're saying. I have a question about the hormone replacement. So essentially you're saying that the hormones that are in the donor's feces are transferred into the recipient, but I would imagine that it would also be that the microbiome that's transferred is healthier, which then therefore helps the body to make more endogenous hormone as well compared to the dysbiotic microbiome. Would that be a correct understanding as well?
I think it would play a role. It's probably more about how the neuroendocrine signals from the bacteria to the HPA axis, I would say, more so than that bacteria actually producing hormones. But yes, yeah, I would expect that would play a role, that there's, that sort of route as well versus just actually like free-formed hormones being kind of like, or hormone precursors being kind of consumed, but just from the other end. So like kind of taking like a hormone replacement pill for a dog, but from the other end.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Great. So, okay, we've talked about how we collect the feces from the donor and how we screen for a good donor, and we've talked about the ideal candidate for a recipient and the procedure. So what happens after you've done, you know, after the sort of 6 hours resting and hopefully not pooing, what happens then? So how often are you seeing the patients back, and what tests are you doing, and how do you know whether it's actually worked, like whether the transplant has been accepted essentially?
So I think the big one is resolution of clinical signs of what the presenting complaints were and what the disease we're looking at. So I would just be using any usual monitoring approaches that we might use for that particular disease. For example, if it was like IBD, I'd be using like an activity index or CRP, because I do a lot of CRP monitoring in autoimmune diseases and IBD. But we're looking at resolution of clinical signs because we're addressing one of the root causes and correcting a root cause. So to me, the benefit is just improvement. Clinical improvement would be the big one. We don't always, historically, we haven't always gone back and done another dysbiosis index like afterwards to check if they if they've had a successful colonization, because A, that test has not been around for many years, and B, sometimes people are so kind of like FMT is kind of the last resort, and if it works then they're just happy and that's that. But certainly nowadays I'd be sort of wanting to review a dysbiosis index perhaps 4 to 12 weeks later to see what's going on, but not always. I think it'd be a case-by-case basis and just manage them and monitor them like I otherwise would if I was doing any other therapy. I expect, like, for example, not that I use very much of it, but if you're using like PRED for IBD, I would do, if I was using PRED for IBD, I would use CRP to monitor that. But if the dog's doing better and the presenting complaints have been abolished, then potentially you don't need to do any follow-up.
Absolutely.
The follow-up to me would be then just like counselling them around diet and ongoing prebiotics, and probably I'd be doing a lot of ongoing gut lining support anyway. I mean, I don't think I would sort of do the FMT and then drop away all therapies. Like I would probably have, that dog would be like a higher risk of relapse regardless of how good the first one went. After maybe after 4 weeks, I'd definitely want to check in at the 4 week mark. Not necessarily before. I'd maybe give a courtesy call from one of our team the day after, just to see how they were after the procedure. But to me, maybe I'd consider another FMT after a couple of months, or I'd be going back to the drawing board and just going back through other root causes that we may have missed, like is there low vitamin D or is there heavy metals or is there some other perpetuating factor that we haven't addressed, go back to food sensitivities and just make sure that we didn't kind of miss anything beforehand. Because and then certainly if one microbiome didn't engraft, I'd probably try different dog's microbiome, and I also would potentially try different biofilm disruptor approaches.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions. If you were to do a repeat transfer in a couple of months, would you usually use the same donor or a different one? And you've sort of just answered that for me.
The other thing to know is if we have a different donor stool at the same occasion, because our bank's slowly growing. But my vision in the future is that we have like male neutered, male entire, female neutered, female entire, young, pregnant, breed, that breed. And then as like we get more 16S RNA sequencing microbiome testing versus like qPCR and actually have way more clarity and a deeper read of like the taxa and onto like a species level, then to me I'd be sort of hoping to have like a mix and match approach, hopefully. In the future, I think this could be easily like AI-driven, that we'd have a way more robust approach to matching a donor. For example, like if a dog has IBD, we might be looking for a donor that has a relatively high abundance of fusobacteria, which is more likely to be effective for a dog with IBD. So that's kind of the future.
Very interesting. And what about any side effects and any like contraindications to doing a transfer? Are there cases that you just would never consider it? I know you've mentioned some of the risks earlier on, but can we talk about some of the negatives?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the and talking about successfulness in general, like acute hemorrhagic diarrhea syndrome, I wouldn't use it for. Probably wouldn't use it if a dog was on immunosuppressive drugs. In fact, I definitely wouldn't use it if they're immunosuppressive. If they're on anti-inflammatory pred doses or corticosteroid doses, I'd use it very cautiously and really only reserve that for dogs that, and which is how we used to start using it, which was like dogs that were really they were like cachexic from chronic enteropathy and like we were really losing them. That's when I would potentially do an FMT for a dog that was still on pred, but ideally I'd try to wean them off pred before doing an FMT. And we usually can do that. But to me, I'd be cautious. I wouldn't use it in an immunosuppressive patient because, like I mentioned, that kind of pathobiont bacteria, that's like a good bacteria gone bad. So we don't have the evidence to say that they truly meet the true definition of probiotics, which not many probiotics actually do in dogs. So there's like Saccharomyces, like Bacillus coagulans, Bacillus subtilis. Like these are the bacteria that are like truly proven to like not cause damage, even, and some people say like to be cautious around using SB in immunosuppressed patients. I don't know if you've got a position on that, but essentially I'd be cautious about immunosuppressed patients. I would try to de-escalate medications if possible for those patients before considering FMT. And then the other thing to note is acute hemorrhagic diarrhea syndrome, I don't think it plays a role. And I think the other risks are only what I mentioned before about low chance but theoretical risk of implanting like the behavioural, like changing the behaviour of the dog, changing, which also people from organ transplants report that as well. I don't know if you've ever heard about that phenomenon.
Yeah, I have. So
same sort of potential deal there. And then you know, that low caution around cancer use, a cancer transfer, which I think is a low risk, but something to be mindful of. And then on the positive side, the other thing to note is I would also warn people that the response rates vary. And like I mentioned, that we don't have like the clarity of depth to say like this microbiome is really what your dog needs. So I'd also warn people that there's a risk of like low grade GI upset or a trigger from implanting the stool, like I would with basically any supplement or drug in a dog that has one of these diseases that has a dysbiosis, that, you know, anything could, like the stress of coming into the vet hospital, even though it's like not very stressful, I'd still sort of preempt that. On a positive note though, like parvovirus, like not in acute hemorrhagic, but in acute diarrhea and in parvo cases have They've halved hospitalization time from like 6 to 3 days and double-blinded random control trials, and also okay. improved mortality rates from like 36% to 22% in this study, although that didn't quite reach statistical significance, but we're like, I think that there's a positive signal there. And then in another one, in just, I think, vague general fecal diarrhea, acute diarrhea, that they had better fecal scores from FMT than metronidazole in one study, and that the their dysbiosis index was returned to normal in the FMT group, but it didn't in the metronidazole group after use.
Well, yeah. That makes sense to me with knowing what metronidazole does. Yeah.
Yeah, and a shout out to try and avoid metronidazole in the first 2 years of a dog's life so that they don't need an FMT, because metronidazole is notorious for wiping out Clostridium huronsis.
Yeah, so, and I know that like after metronidazole, it's highly unlikely that the microbiome will ever recover to a healthy state or to the sort of pre-antibiotic state. I've seen that research as well.
Without FMT.
Yeah, without FMT. I have a question. So if a dog has an FMT and it's been successful and you're treating a dog for something else, let's say it has a cutaneous wound that becomes infected and you do have to give antibiotics, because I know we try not to use antibiotics, but they do have a time and a place, do you then consider this dog at high risk for needing a future FMT? Do you just go and give it one in a couple of months anyway, knowing its history, or do you just wait and see how it goes?
Yeah, good question. Actually, I forgot. This is another thing that we've been doing, and this has come from people that I know that have had chemo. I have had a dog that had recurrent mast cell tumors, and mm-hmm. he also has a subaortic stenosis, and he needed a dental. And the cardiologist was like, you should do antibiotics for the periodontal because it can risk a decompensation of the SAS.
Cardiac disease.
And we're like, okay, but we've like, this dog's like 3 years into remission just from like serial low grade MCTs, not ever a high grade, thankfully. But we're like, but I'm worried that he was at risk of a high grade. So we're like, look, this dog's microbiome's come a long way. We've done like 4 years of gut work and he's not had a mast cell tumor for like a long time. So what we did was we auto transferred his microbiome. So we took the FMT, we put it in the freezer. They did the antibiotics and then we gave him back his own FMT. And I know humans that do that before and after chemo.
Before and after chemo, and what about before and after antibiotics for humans? Is there many people doing that? I guess it's a bit extreme.
But I would probably, I've considered it for my child, having some in the freezer.
Do you have some in the freezer?
Not yet. Not yet, but I probably should, because they need. But by the time they need the antibiotics, it might be too late to get a sample. But yeah, I think that's the future. I don't think it's craziness to have like. I mean, obviously, I live in this world, but I don't think it's crazy to have like a poop sample of your dog in your freezer at the vets or something. But the other thing to note is a shout out, like. If people think that their dog might meet the criteria for being a donor, like it's great if your dog's a donor, because if something happens and they need antibiotics, then they can have their own stool back.
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually going to ask how you recruit donors in your practice. Do you just ask people who have, the ideal dog?
So the microbiome takes 2 years to really grow out. So the microbiome, so the minute a dog's 2 years old, often we'd be talking in our practice, because we do a lot of kind of very intense preventative proactive medicine, where we'd be doing like talking about like longevity at 2 years and doing like functional blood tests, like that we might be sending their vitamin D to America, or we might be, or the clients might be asking about checking on their dog's microbiome anyway, or we're doing blood work, including like CRP to see if it's like ultra low, things like that. Like that's relatively mm-hmm. common in a subsection of our practice. The minute that I have a dog that in my eyes that I've been working with and also monitoring their behavior, which is so tricky nowadays to find dogs that have good behavior, which is terrible. But, and I think it's a commentary of the state of the microbiome, is that the minute that a dog I identify as being like 2 years old and the client's receptive, likely to be receptive to it, or even if they're not and the dog's like a good fit, I would just ask. Like, we don't miss opportunities for FMD donors. Like, if a dog's a really lovely, sweet natured dog that's 2 years old, not had antibiotics, not had gut problems, not had allergies, you know, that's not that many dogs. Even with like good preventative medicine, that's still tricky to find.
Yeah. And they're generally happy, and they collect the feces just into a like a dog bag and bring it in. Is it as simple as that? And then you put it in a deep freeze?
Yeah, we normally give them we do doggy bags, or we give them like specimen like urine specimen containers and things. But yeah, we just have them refrigerate it and then bring it in for processing. Or I've collected it from people's houses a few times just because it's so valuable. Once we've identified a donor, that we want to make it as easy as possible for them.
And it doesn't matter if the poo contacts the ground?
No. They might get some bacillus probiotics in there as well.
Some soil-based probiotics, never harmful. Yeah. Well, can't be harmful, obviously, but yeah.
Well, some are harmful.
Amazing.
I think tuberculosis. I think it's really exciting. I think more research is obviously needed. I think that it's important to note that it's not necessarily a first sign, but I think as we learn, as we learn more, we hope to incorporate it earlier into protocols so that there's less trial and error, less frustration, less suffering for the dog, like waiting, like, you know, if we can address dysbiosis before a dog ever ends up on, say, steroids for gut issues or skin issues, then to me, like steroids might be good to like save a dog's life with that really terrible IBD, but it's known to reduce quality of life and reduce like behavioral happiness scores and things. So to me, having the confidence and conviction with our approach and our interpretation of the research and trying to contribute meaningfully to the literature is. My hope is that it is brought forward and done sooner rather than later.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's very exciting. And I know we're nearly up for time, but I just have one more question. Has there been any FMTs done in cats?
Yes. Yes, we've done one. We've done a couple for EGC, eosinophilic granuloma complex.
Okay, interesting. But not necessarily for IBD in cats, small cell lymphoma.
We wouldn't have used it knowingly in small cell lymphoma, but we have used it in a couple of feline IBD cases. But cats with IBD, they tend to be we tend to find they're more easily managed than dogs often. So we haven't really, and we also see a lot more dogs than cats. So, used it in more atopic disorders in cats. And I'd maybe consider it for pancreatitis as well. So for cats with that triaditis,
Triaditis. Yeah. Yep. Great. Okay. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I just love talking to you on the podcast as always. So glad we're going to be talking more and more in the future. I know we've gone through a lot of detail today, but is there anything that you've left out that you wanted to share with our listeners? Or do you feel that we've covered everything really well?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk about this and super excited to be part of the team with Pure Animal to be able to dive deep into these really interesting topics. I think that's pretty much it. I think the main thing for me is like, hopefully it's not needed. And to me, we should be starting to think about curating the microbiome of a dog from ideally during the mother's pregnancy. And getting the diet right and getting the environment right. And there's going to be a lot of research, more research coming out of the Dog Risk Project in Finland about the role of the environment for colonizing the microbiome. But and really I think we should be focusing on getting that microbiome healthy up to 2 years of a pet's life. And my main message to people is learn about the microbiome. Like if it seems like an overwhelming topic, like it's going to be playing a major role in precision medicine. It's super exciting. It's super modifiable, and we've got many tools at our availability, and it can really change clinical outcomes in my experience and my interpretation of the research. So I think it's a great one to dive into, even if you're just dipping your toe in the water of integrative medicine. The microbiome's not weird and out there. It's like the internal medicines. I know internal medicine specialists in Sydney that are using FMT on select cases, and it's coming into the mainstream, and it's time to really dive in.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great way to finish our wonderful chat today. And I know you've probably got to get on with your busy day, so I'll let you go and we'll chat to you again really soon. Thank you so much again, Matt.
My pleasure. Take care. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of the Pure Animal Podcast. I'm Dr. Sarah Howard, and make sure you tune in next month where we'll be talking to Dr. Wendy Boltzer about geriatric joint care. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for individualised veterinary advice, and listeners should ensure to seek advice from their pet's own veterinary professional.